KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd.
Hey, Ray!
Strasso, how do you do, sir?
Pretty good. It's a strange weekend here. I don't know when this podcast will go out, but it's Labor Day weekend. We are expecting record heat, not just record heat, but record-shattering heat wave. It's already 95 degrees at 10 a.m. in Ojai, California. It's expecting to get to 110 today Fahrenheit, possibly 115 tomorrow on Sunday, September 6th.
I don't think I could function in that kind of heat, man. I've been living in a gray cloud for 37 years of my 66 years have been spent in this sort of gray, rainy place. And
yeah, but the gray, rainy clouds of Ketchikan is what makes it so beautiful, and it gives the old-growth forests thousands of years of misty fjords and fern gullies and moss-covered glades.
But just like you, man, you really dig all that California sunshine, but then there's a point where, like, I'm dreaming of the rainforest, right? So I love the rainforest, man.
I don't mind the heat. I've taken some Mojave Desert trips in the summer when it's 100 degrees out, and you manage your water, you manage your time, you sit in the shade from 11 to 2 and read, you know, books on nature. That's when I would read The Silent Spring, and I'd read Desert Solitaire, and I'd read that fantastic The Island Within, which is that book that totally turned me on to Ketchikan before, well, the Pacific Northwest and the whole Southeast Alaska. That totally turned me on.
Yeah. Oh, Richard Nelson is the author. He recently passed away. He was a really cool dude. He lived in Sitka for many years. He wrote that beautiful book.
When I heard the NPR review of that book, they had a soundscape in the background, and believe it or not, it was one of those driveway moments where I pulled my car in and I couldn't do anything until I heard this radio story. And I was frozen in my car because they had the crows and the seashore ambiance. It's exactly what I try to do with this podcast, is make you, you are there.
Yeah, Richard did a lot of actually soundscapes and recording himself. So yeah, he was an incredible force here in Southeast. It's a real loss for the planet, but Richard was one cool guy. I got to hang out with him a number of times over the years. And hey, Dave, I got this thing that, you know, I'm into fish, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm way deep into fish. And I can't explain this obsession, but I moved to Alaska 37 years ago, and I tumbled into the world of fish. And soon
I know what it is.
What's that?
The reason why you are into fish is guilt. It's Catholic guilt from all the fish you killed.
That's right.
And you just posted a couple weeks ago, you posted that my second favorite troll drawing, painting, of you lying in bed, and the ghosts of all the fish you caught and killed are there staring at you, saying, why, Ray?
It's a little of my Catholic upbringing. I love the fish, and I kill the fish. I'm tortured by it. But I tumbled into the world of fish, and soon, it happened. My career was, I found this audience with fish and fishing and all this stuff. And I did a book with my buddy Brad Mattson. Our first one was called Shocking Fish Tales. And then in our second book, I convinced Brad to come along with me. And much like with you, whatever, we were into paleo stuff, we convinced a publisher that we would do a book in paleontology. So two guys, he's a journalist and I'm the artist guy. And we launched off on a book that later became Planet Ocean, Dancing to the Fossil Record, went on a great road trip together, talked to many scientists, and there was a moment at the LA County Museum, I remember this in 1992 or so, that's back when I saw the buzzsaw shark for the first time, but we were sitting with a paleontologist, his name was J.D. Stewart, he was working there at the LA County Museum of Natural History at that time, and we were having cocktails with J.D. after we had toured the collection, and he said, you know, Ray, you're into fish. Do you know that you are a fish? And I was like, what do you mean? And
is this a deodorant joke?
No, you are a fish. And it's like, you know, this idea that we actually are. I was so into fish that I'd forgotten it. And if you read your science books, we are fish, man. And that's, you know, today's person that we're going to be talking to. I'm hoping to clarify this statement. I want to say this statement. We are derived bony fish. We are wayward sarcopterygian fishes. I am waving my fingers here because
Sarcopterygian. I know that I keep messing that word up in past episodes. Define sarcopterygian again.
Well, it is a particular kind of lobe-finned fish. These are fish that have a bony structure in their fins. They're separate than the other ray-finned fish.
Okay, so we're not related to ray-finned fish, well, Ray. We're related to sarcopterygians because have the arm bones. They have the primordial arm bones in there.
Right. Primitive arm bones.
But how is it that you cannot... Why is it so surprising that you think or you know we're related to fish? If you go back in the... We're related to single-cell prokaryotes and
prokaryotes, I think, is there. Something like that.
And the other one is eukaryote.
Yeah.
Which has a nucleus.
Yes.
But we're related to those little fellas.
Well, we are related, one of the things, Dave, I guess, you know, in these cladograms and these evolutionary trees... It's whether or not you are nested within that group, right?
Right.
So we all have these common ancestors, and then as we split off from them, you know, so it's like the Hatfields and McCoy. You're descended from this group over here. You belong to that group. You're still, no matter generations down, I'm a Hatfield. You know, belong to the bony fish tribe.
Okay, I get it. And when you look at this tree of life, of all the organisms that existed and the ones that branch off and die out or don't die out, humans represent only one branch, while all the most of it, 70-80% of all these other branches are not us.
Right. We're a branch coming off of the, well, it's a complicated branch, but along the way, you know, we had a fishy phase. Actually, we are the spawn of tunicates, man. Tunicates.
Tuna fish?
No, not tuna fish, man. Those are ray fins.
Well, what's a tunicate?
It's a sea squirt.
What?
It's a sea squirt, man. So it's like a little warty looking thing and we are the spawn. And they're actually sort of close to the echinoderms and starfish and all this mind blowing stuff. But sea squirts then become, you know, the hint of a backbone is in there. So then there's the fish and there's the bony fish. And then there's the ray fin fish, but we're within the bony fish. The ray fins go over here, and we're with the lobe fins.
So at one time, we're a bony fish, but then we branch out into the lobe fish.
Yeah, we are with the lobe fins. And the other lobe fin fish that are still around in their lobe fin form are only the coelacanths and the lungfish. And for a long time...
But lungfish don't have... Do they have little flipper hand things?
Actually, if you look at...
I thought they were like long eel-like.
Those are the African lungfish and South American lungfish have those sort of eel-like appendages. They're derived. But there's a beautiful one from Australia, where people know about you, Dave.
Don't even try it.
I can semi-talk Aussie.
Yeah, our guest is Australian today, so...
He's going to speak heavy Aussie, I think.
Yeah, he does.
And I love that sound. But anyways, so the lobe-finned fish, there's only the lungfish and coelacanths. And it turns out, through genetic testing and all that, we're actually closer to the lungfish than we are to the coelacanths. And, you know, with the lungfish, if you hold it underwater, you'll drown it, you know?
Right.
So think about that.
Well, it is a lungfish.
That's right. But then those fish, that group of fish, somewhere in that group of fish, and John knows all about this, we'll find out the particular ones, But that group of fish is what begins to inhabit the swampy areas of the planet, and then eventually are up on the land. And those become the early tetrapods, which become the early amphibians.
Which means four tetrapods.
And they're walking around on land, like pteranauts, if you will.
So this coelacanth, which looks like it's pronounced coelacanth, has these four lobe fins, correct?
Yes.
And are they literally unchanged for 340 million years, or have they evolved over time to kind of look like what they did in the Devonian, but in today's age they've changed a little bit?
They evolved in the Devonian and they flourished. There were many, many kinds of lobe-finned fishes, and there were some that were monstrous, huge.
I'm talking about just the coelacanths.
They flourished. There were many kinds of them. The modern-day coelacanth looks pretty much like the Devonian coelacanth, but then they disappeared from the fossil record at the end of the Cretaceous. They went with the Great Mass Extinction, and we thought there were none left on the planet at all.
Of course.
And then in 1938...
Off of Madagascar.
Lady Latimer, off of Madagascar, off of...
Wait, is that a lady or a ship that found it in the net?
It was a woman, an ichthyologist, Lady Latimer.
Oh, she identified it.
Yes, she's the one who discovered it. She was actually, it was in a fish market. She said, I didn't know about that. Something, I can't do it. Anyways, she's the one who said in the fish market, oh my God, that is a coelacanth. And she did the paper on it. She worked with several people. And actually, I was inducted into a group called the Society for the Protection of Old Fish, SPOOF. And as part of being part of SPOOF, Lady Latimer, this is a group of ichthyologists. She would write an introductory letter, and they send you a scale of a coelacanth and a letter from Lady Latimer. And I actually have that. And I am in the Society for Protection of Old Fish. So this means a lot to me, this guy we're talking to today. He's going to clear it up.
Yeah. We have an amazing guest on today's show.
Oh,
and I'm
man.
Laughing right now because I just made a mistake and I'm doing this over. So he is, I've been to his office in Australia. And in his office, it's a tiny little office, but it has some of the most iconic fossils that we're about to talk about planet.
Yeah.
On the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the guy is actually technically a paleoichthyologist. Certifiable paleoichthyologist means he's a fish guy, prehistoric fish guy, and he's got some way important things, you know, that mean a lot to me. I really am super excited to meet him. I was in his office when he was in L.A.
Oh, that's right. He was in the Natural History Museum, L.A. County.
He was the vice president there, but he went back home where you are a big deal, and I want to
back
ask
home,
him a
right?
moment. Yeah. You can speak it Aussie with him.
Our paleo nerd guest today is a celebrated Australian paleontologist whose immense body of work has yielded important insights into fish evolution and the origins of vertebrate reproduction. Now, I'm not reading this, by the way. I just is off my head.
Well done.
He's an award-winning author who's collected fossils from Iran to Antarctica, and he's currently the strategic professor of paleontology at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia. And I've been in his office, which I just said, at Flinders University, and seen a fossil of a very important fish, which we're going to talk about today.
Oh, man, I am so thrilled. Can we call him up, man? I'm super excited.
Me too. Please welcome John Long.
Great to be here.
Hey, John.
Hi.
I'm realizing there's one thing. You're a very special, special guest so far on the show because you're the only other person that I know that has actually sat through a David Strassman show.
Ladies and gentlemen, David Strassman!
I have indeed.
Well, how is it that Dave connects with Australians like yourself?
Well, A, he likes fossils and paleontology, but also he's a talented comedian. And so, you know, I actually went to one of his shows many, many years ago before I even knew he was interested in paleontology.
Did you? When was that? Was that Melbourne?
Probably Melbourne, yeah.
Here's a tip on Aussie lingo. When you're down under, most Aussies call Melbourne, Australia, Melbourne. G'day, mate. I'm from Melbourne.
Wow.
Yeah.
So then when I was over there in 2018, I didn't get to see you, but Dave got to see you, went to your office. And John, just quickly, what's your backstory? How did you become a paleontologist?
Well, I suppose I'm like one of those nerdy kids that started collecting fossils at some ridiculously young age. I think I was 7, and the kid next to me at school, father used to collect fossils, so we got invited out to collect fossils one day. Went to this quarry out at the outskirts of Melbourne, a place called Lilydale, and there I found a trilobite, and that was like a most amazing thing because, A, it was Devonian, and it told me that creatures lived hundreds of millions of years ago, and that where I was standing was actually under the sea. And that just blew my tiny little elementary school mind.
That's amazing. That's so, such a great find.
It started with a fossil, and that you eventually became a fish guy, totally a fish guy, right?
Yeah, well, in those early days, we started collecting fossils from many different sites that were local to the Melbourne district. And we're one of those cities in Melbourne which has all sorts of fantastic fossil sites, like Beaumaris, where you can find big shark's teeth, like megalodon teeth if you're really lucky, whale bones and fossil penguin bones and things like that, along with a lot of older sites, you know, with Ordovician graptolites and Devonian trilobites and shelly faunas and things. Eventually, we started catching trains out to the countryside and collecting fossil mammals and bones of ancient reptiles and dinosaurs and things. And, you know, I built up a big fossil collection. But the thing that nobody was working on at the time was fish.
Mm.
So when I entered university, I went to Melbourne University for a couple of years. And Tom and Pat Rich had just arrived from America and took up positions in Melbourne. And so these were like the first real vertebrate paleontologists we'd ever had in Victoria. And so I immediately changed universities and went from Melbourne to Monash to enroll with Pat Rich.
Okay.
And then she said, well, what sort of projects do you want to do? And then at the time, another American who was at Monash called Professor Jim Warren had been digging up these amazing Devonian fishes from the mountains of central Victoria. And I'm not just talking scraps or bits and pieces. I'm talking whole complete fossil fishes in all stages of growth, from larvae through to big fellas. And you know what? Not a single person was working on them.
No.
So they gave me a simple project for my honours on Bothrylepis, this ancient armoured placoderm, you know, a bit like this fella.
I know it well, yeah.
You know, yeah. More boxy kind of thing. And then from there, I had my choice of the whole fauna to work on for my PhD. And every single thing was a new species, a new genus, or a new family. So that's why I got into fossil fish.
Wow, that's exciting. Wow.
What kind of strata were the Victorian fish in? Were they in mudstones or limestone? Or?
That's a good question, Dave. They're actually an ancient lake deposit. So they're in black shales that split. You know, with a chisel, they would just split like perfect, even sheets.
These are freshwater fish, then?
Freshwater fishes from an ancient lake, volcanic lake, surrounded by volcanoes. It would periodically erupt and blanket those lakes with ash, which probably killed all the fish, which meant they died as whole, complete fish and got buried in the very quiet environment. So they were beautifully preserved, and it was a joy to work on them.
Well, I want to ask you some fishy questions, and we're going to get to the sexier bits a little bit later, if we might. But
absolutely.
But I like to tell people, John, that we are more fish than not. Most people can get the connection between us and apes, and they look at monkey. And as you go back a little bit farther, it gets a little hazier. And most people are shocked to find out that we really are derived lobe-finned fish.
Absolutely.
And you agree, we are more fish than not, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, people often ask me how my career has gone working on ancient dead fish, you know, it's gone so well. And I say, well, for many, many years, I used to just collect dead fish and describe them. And I wrote these like papers that were almost in isolation. And then one day the penny dropped that what I was really doing was looking at the roadmap to the human body plan.
Wow.
And so from that point on, I started getting every grant I applied for, and we got lots of funding and built up teams. And it was really because the essential message I was getting across was we studied these ancient fish because embedded in them is the origins of all the systems, all the anatomical systems that make us human, the beginnings of arms and legs, the beginnings of jaws and teeth, the beginnings of a skull with paired bones, and behaviors too, like the beginnings of breathing, the beginnings of complex sexual reproduction. So all of these things come down to when did they first evolve in evolution? And the answer, more often than not, is in the Devonian.
Wow, you know, the Devonian is such a cool time. If I could travel back in time, that's where I would go to. But now,
what are the million years? What are the years of the Devonian?
They started about 419 million years ago and ended at 359 million years ago. So it's a pretty long period.
419 to 350, yeah.
But somewhere in there, about 380, 375. Yeah. There was a very important transition that happened, and this is what I've been, you know, blowing my mind all these years. There was a group of fish, and when I was a young man, like yourself, John, we were told it was Eustachnopteron, the strong, low-finned fish, that crawled out of the Devonian pool because it was dry and it needed to get to another. That was what Romer and all the other folks were saying. But now that whole story has changed. And you have been really at the forefront of it. And Tiktaalik took the lead for a while as the link between fish and tetrapods right there.
Yeah, Tiktaalik is like a salamander type.
Kinda. That's it right there.
Oh my God, you have the head.
I do. Bring me the head of Tiktaalik.
Tiktaalik.
No, it's actually a cast, of course.
Of course.
The most exciting thing, and the news came out as this pandemic started stretching around the planet, extraordinary news, Elpistostege is now the closest link, and your name is on that paper, and fish had fingers.
Yep.
So I've been talking for a while. What's that all about, John?
Okay. Well, as we know, Tiktaalik, which was discovered by Neil Shubin and Ted Daichler and Farris Jenkins, was a landmark fish back in 2006 because it revealed so much of the structure of these fish. They were almost land animals. They're almost tetrapods. And Tiktaalik was the poster boy for that transition. And it still is a very important fossil. So don't get me wrong. The trouble was Tiktaalik wasn't complete. It had bits missing. And so Elpistostege was known since the 1930s by isolated bits, you know, a bit of a skull and later on a bit of a snout. But in 2010, a group of Canadians in Quebec, because the site at Miguasha is in Quebec, and my good colleague and friend that I work with, Richard Cloutier, was part of the team that excavated an entire complete Elpistostege from tip of snout to tip of tail.
Wow.
Every single part of that fish was complete and preserved. It was a bit squashed, but we put it through the synchrotron and micro CT scanners. Well, a synchrotron and the micro CT are basically an X-ray machine that takes three-dimensional series of slices. And so from that, with the right software, we can build a virtual reconstruction.
You can uncompress it.
We do. We can do anything we like. We can uncompress it, and we can actually look inside those squashed flat fins and look at the individual patterns of bones that were present.
Now, these are Devonian tetrapods?
These are what we call stem tetrapods, Dave, which are fish on the stem leading to tetrapods. So they're almost tetrapods.
In the Devonian.
In the late Devonian. This is about 380 million years ago.
Technically still a fish, basically. But
still a fish because it has fins with fin rays.
Right.
So technically speaking, a tetrapod has fingers, you know, that don't have fin rays, fingers and toes. But what we discovered with Elpistostege was that within the pectoral fin, which is the equivalent to your arm, we had a series of bones that grayed out into a series of digits in serial rows, which are exactly the same as the digits in your hand. And indeed, we said they're homologous to the phalangeal bones or digit bones of other tetrapods. But the trouble was they were still embedded in a fin with fin rays on the outside. So we had the perfect intermediate condition that one would expect in evolution, that finger bones started in the fish, but they didn't really develop into true fingers until they'd lost those fin rays and the finger bones then became digits, you know, free-form digits.
And what is the adaptation that would it be walking on land? That is why the fin rays disappear and the finger bones become more prominent?
Probably. That's our best guess, shall we say. We know that things like Tiktaalik had enough of those bones preserved in the wrist that it could have supported its weight to probably push the head up. One of the big discoveries that is not just in the fin, but in the head. And when we look at this head here, I'm holding up of Tiktaalik, which is very similar to the head of Elpistostege, we see these massive big holes right here on either side of the back of the head. And they are actually how the fish was breathing. They were breathing through these spiracles into the buccal cavity that would then swallow air into the lung. And how do we know this? Well, I discovered a fish from Go-Go many years ago called Go-Go Nasus. I actually named it in 1985 because it was only known from a little snout collected by the British Museum expeditions in the 60s. So only having a snout, I called it Go-Go Nasus, which means snout from Go-Go.
Right.
But in 1986, when I had my first big expedition up to this site, which is in the far north of Western Australia, I found a whole complete skull of this fish, Go-Go Nasus. Now, for your listeners out there, why is this important? Well, when we see lots of fossil fish that are squashed flat like pancakes in the rock, Go-Go's the opposite. We have whole three-dimensional fish preserved in limestone, which when we put in baths of weak acetic acid, which basically like strong vinegar, it dissolves that rock away and the bones poke out in three dimensions and we apply glue to them. And by repeating that process, we get the whole skeleton out of the rock and it's like it died yesterday. So there's so much anatomy we can interpret from these Go-Go fishes that we can't get from other sites. So here's the connection then to Tiktaalik and Opisthostege. One of the complete skulls of Go-Go Nasus that we found from Go-Go on another expedition showed it had the same big holes on top of the head. And it got us thinking, well, what are these big holes called spiracles doing on top of the head? So at the time, I moved to America and took up a position in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History. And I started working with a talented team down at Scripps Institute that was led by the late Jeff Graham, who worked on the physiology of air-breathing fishes. And they captured a population of these fish called polypterus, you know, the birdshear fish from Africa, and had them in a big aquarium. And they were studying them, and they found that the old naturalists that had first collected them, you know, or first observed them in the lakes, had heard this popping, sucking noise coming from the lake at night. And they didn't know what it was, but the team in the lab at Scripps realized they were sucking air in through the spiracles on top of the head, which went directly into their lungs.
Wow.
So it was proof that these spiracles on top of the head were a direct way of getting air into their lungs. So that was the link.
That's what blew my mind, and I was reading up on this yesterday, and I finally figured out the spiracular breathing you were talking about, because I look at Tiktaalik and Opisthostege, they have flat heads, flat eyes on top, and I was like, what in the hell are the nostrils? But the nostrils are on the underside.
Exactly, they're under here.
Yeah, so but I was like, how are you breathing if you're poking your head up? And then I realized when I read the paper and I looked at that, they're breathing through the top of their head.
That's exactly right, Ray. Well, the thing
is, what is the environmental reason that this organism would have to breathe through the top of its head? Obviously, lifting his head out of the water, but why would it form air up top?
That's a very good question, but Dave, but we think that this thing was acting a bit like a crocodile, you know, and so they're rising up to the surface of the water and they're using their eyes, which are on top of their head, to sort of spot prey that could be on land, you know, like giant centipedes and things like that that they might like to eat. But at the same time, breathing in fishes is through the gills. But if you're making more and more short forays onto land, you want to get air some other way. And we know that a number of living fishes, like the lungfishes, can actually breathe air or top up their oxygen by taking air in through their lungs, but they have to gulp the air and swallow it. They don't have chest muscles like we have. Neither did these fish. They don't have the kind of ribs and chest structure that we, you know, they wouldn't have been able to breathe with a diaphragm. So the other way of getting it is through these spiracles that go straight into the back of the throat. And they can suck the air in through their buccal pump mechanism and then get it down into the lungs. That's the only explanation we can think of.
Could they also get it through their nostrils and through their mouth if they wanted to?
Well, we always confuse nostrils with breathing because we humans breathe through our noses. But don't forget, what's the original use of noses?
To smell.
Exactly. It's olfaction. It's for smelling things in the water. That's what fish use their nostrils for. And these early tetrapod-like fish were probably still using their nostrils for sensing smells and finding food and using their other structures for breathing.
There's one other weird thing on top of the head. There's a pineal eye. Is there not a third eye there?
Yeah, this thing's got a third eye, a pineal eye, and that carries right through from the very first jawless fishes 500 million years ago right through to reptiles, fairly advanced reptiles. And it's believed to be an outpocketing of the brain that is the pineal organ or parapineal organ. Sometimes it's paired, basically light sensitive. So it probably orientates creatures which way is up, you know, when they're trying to concentrate on so many other things, especially if you're in dark.
You couldn't see behind itself.
Yeah, if you're in dark or murky water and there's a glimmer of...
Are there any pineal eyes in any organisms today? A third eye?
Yeah, of course. Not an actual eye, but probably an organ, but it's below the surface.
A light-sensing organ?
I believe so, but I'm not an expert on reptiles, but...
the Tuatara has one.
It does indeed.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. The New Zealand Tuatara.
Yep.
John, how certain can we be looking at El Pisto Stege that that's our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa, grandma?
Let grandpa tell you a story. Sit around, everybody. Once upon a time, when I was a little tetrapod in the Devonian 240 million years ago, I was in the swamp, and that's where I met your grandmother. I was sunning myself.
Could you feel pretty certain that's the invasion happened once, don't you think? Or multiple times? Or is that grandma there that we're looking at?
That's highly controversial. First of all, Ray, I agree with you that it's the closest thing we have on our deep, deep ancestral, you know, ancestry.com by 10 to the 6 kind of thing. But to be honest, the question of how many times did they invade land is still controversial because we have a disjunct here. We have a beautiful record of these fish-like tetrapods in the late Devonian and early tetrapods appearing just after them, especially from Greenland and North America and, you know, those wonderful sites, Russia. A lot of new fantastic work by Per Alberg and his team have been revealing that there's probably now over a dozen different tetrapods from the Devonian.
Wow.
Where for many, many years we only had a handful, you know, two or three kind of thing. But here's the rub. We have trackways of tetrapods from sites in Poland and sites in Australia and sites in Ireland that I've been working on with Per Alberg, and they're much older than the earliest remains of tetrapods.
Wow, okay.
So do we have a missing sort of ghost record of tetrapods here, that tetrapods were walking around? These are not just any old trackways. They've got clear digit marks. They've got some of them are resting traces of the whole body of the animal on the substrate.
But when you say tetrapod, you're talking about an organism with four limbs.
Yep.
Not necessarily an amphibian.
No. Well, the earliest tetrapods were amphibians in the loose sense, but not what we'd call the modern amphibia, which, you know, frogs and newts and
I mean a transitional animal from ocean to land.
Absolutely, Dave. Tetrapod, as you're right, means four arms and legs, and it's that basic pattern. But when we refer to tetrapods in this conversational sense that I'm talking, I mean something with fingers and toes and, you know, an actual walking animal kind of thing. So it leaves a distinct set of trackways, sometimes with tail drag marks, sometimes with they're swimming and just the toes are touching. We've got a whole different range of the way they have moved based on trackway evidence. But the trackway evidence goes much older than the record of fossil bones, so that's the problem.
How old are those tracks? How much further back do they go?
Well, the oldest definite ones that we're confident with are the ones from Poland, from the Zahelny Formation area, the Zahelny Quarry, I mean. And they're sort of the beginning of the Middle Devonian. They're sort of about 390 million years or so.
The Devonian period, also known as the Age of Fishes, lasted for 60 million years. It's divided into three epochs, or epochs, as Dave keeps saying, lower, middle, and upper. Those three epochs are then subdivided into stages or ages. For instance, the upper or last epoch in the Devonian has two stages, the Frasnian and the Feminian. Somewhere in there, our fishy ancestors crawled ashore.
And the oldest definite bones of these sort of tetrapods are from the late Frasnian. We're talking about 375. So we're talking 375 to 390. Yeah, it's about a 15 million year kind of gap, which is a long time when we've got such a good fossil record and so many sites around the world that, show these kind of fossils.
So maybe we don't have the grandma fish yet.
We don't have necessarily the whole story.
The whole story.
Exactly.
That's really mind-blowing. Wow.
You do have a fish that is a mother.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And let me see if I got this right. It's Mater Pisces?
Yeah, Mater Pisces, if we use the Latin pronunciation, which just means mother fish. And this, I believe, is one of the greatest discoveries that my team has ever made, and I love telling this story. I've been going back to this site, GoGo, because it's such beautiful three-dimensional preservation for many, many years.
Describe the GoGo Reef and where it is and what it was, because it's an amazing locality in Western Australia, in the Kimberleys.
Oh, it's totally amazing. It's just mind-blowing. Imagine the Great Barrier Reef with all the water taken away and then just give it a patina of age. And then you're walking around these valleys in the desert of northern Australia with these giant cliffs of limestone sticking up, and the fossils are still in situ. You know, there's corals and there's shells and there's creatures that lived on and about the reef. And then in the basins away from those ranges, we get mudstones where the fish that floated and died and then sunk into the mud became entombed in these nodules. And with erosion over millions of years, the valley floors are littered with hundreds of these nodules everywhere. And so my team comes along and we smash those nodules with a hammer. And if we're lucky, we might find one good fish per person per day. So it's about 8 hours work to find one good GoGo fish. Mm. But with a team of people there for 2 or 3 weeks, we eventually get a good collection together. And I've been going back to this site now for 33 years. The last trip was last year. First trip was 86. So 34 years, yeah. So that's basically how my scientific career has been built on these discoveries at GoGo. So people always ask me, what was your most exciting find ever at GoGo? And it has to come down to the motherfish, Mater Pisces attenboroughi, because we named it after Sir David Attenborough.
Very
and
nice.
He was absolutely delighted and chuffed to have this fish named after him. So what was it? It was just an ordinary kind of boring placoderm when we found it. You know, armored-plated fish that lived in the Devonian, now extinct.
The placoderms were armored-plated fish that flourished in the Silurian and Devonian periods and then disappeared from the fossil record at the beginning of the Carboniferous period. They were among the first fish with jaws on our planet. They dominated the seas during the Devonian and came in a multitude of shapes and sizes. Bothriolepsis, for instance, was a fairly common genus back in the placoderm heyday. It was a slow-moving bottom dweller that reached about 2 feet in length, and it looked sort of like a clumsy crab with its long, armored pectoral fins and really weird-looking. And then there were the arthrodires, another order of placoderms whose true rock star member was Dunkleosteus, a massive fish that reached 20 feet or more with huge bony plates in its mouth, used to shear its hapless prey apart. Oh, yeah.
And as it came out of the acid bath, we noticed something very strange. We had the whole fish, including the tail, which is quite rare for GoGo. And in that area of the gut, just behind where the head and the trunk parts are, we found the remains of a tiny little fish inside it. And we thought, ooh, this is interesting. It's its last meal, something it ate just before it died. But then as we looked more carefully, we saw it was a miniature of the adult, the same species. You know, it had those distinctive tooth plates that we could tell it was the same species and not something else. And then I put it back in the acid very gently with very low dilutions of acid, like about 1 or 2% instead of 10%, what we normally use, for an hour at a time, and just very gently peel that last layer away. And what I was able to reveal was an embryonic fish still attached by an umbilical cord to a vug in the rock with crystals that was probably the yolk sac. And indisputable evidence this was an embryo of the same fish inside the mother. So why was this so important? Well, placoderms are thought to be generally primitive fish at the bottom of the, you know, the evolution of fish tree, as you guys know. Having internal fertilization, you know, means that the mother is rearing the young inside her and then giving birth to relatively well-developed pups, like sharks do, or some sharks lay big eggs, as you know, but others give birth to live young. And so this is a fairly advanced kind of reproduction. It's not like your trout sporting in water with thousands of eggs that praying that one or two of them will survive to adulthood and carry on the species,
right,
kind of thing.
The broadcast spawners out there.
Exactly. And all your wonderful artwork about yeah. spawn till you die and all this, you know.
Bring it around to salmon and sex, but yeah.
Woo.
Go on, yeah. John. This is getting good. Tell us more.
So back to the motherfish, the really cool thing about it was having these soft tissues preserved that showed these were umbilical structures. And then we realized, we're sitting having a beer at Gavin Young's house, he's another famous fish paleontologist, and it suddenly dawned on me, he said, "Gentlemen, we've discovered the first fossil F-K." And I basically said, "You're right, Gavin, we've actually discovered the origin of sex here."
Wow.
Because we were so, you know, happy that we found the embryo and that we had internal fertilization. But then the actual act of copulation, you know, internal fertilization where the male deposits sperm inside the female, the only proof you can have of that in a fossil is really to have an embryo inside that animal. And that's what we've nailed.
But don't you have to find the parts, for example, the claspers and the cloaca that the clasper fits into?
The naughty bits. Yes,
the naughty bits.
Yes.
The naughty bits.
Indeed.
Which, by the way, I've got a little side note. I've read your book, Dawn of the Deed.
Wonderful.
Which is the very safe American title, where the actual title of your book is called Hung Like an Argentine Duck.
Exactly right, Dave. It's that's the Australian publisher gave that title to it, not me.
Oh,
but that's because
the
Argentine duck has the largest penis of any bird alive today. It's like a normal duck that has normal sized duck with like a 42 centimeter, what's that in, you know, foot and a half length.
It's well endowed, yes.
Indeed.
But I love Dawn. I think Dawn of the Deed is, that's a cool title too, man. So
yeah, that is.
Yeah.
It's a great book. But, you know, obviously that book, you start off by talking about the Argentine duck, and that's why the publisher mentioned that. But so what was the next fossil that showed claspers, the actual male organ that would have impregnated this madrepiscus?
The prehistoric willy.
Yes, the prehistoric willy, the todger, the ancient todger. Anyway, so these fish, the placoderms, like any other major group of animals, have several different, you know, families or orders, if you like. And the ptyctodonts were the group that the motherfish was. And we've known since the 1930s that the males and females have different pelvic structures there. But in the 1960s, they realized that this one group of placoderms, the ptyctodonts, did have claspers on the male.
They had sexual dimorphism.
That's correct. But only in this one group of placoderms, where the vast majority of the placoderms, say that the biggest group are called the arthrodires, the things like Big Mean Dunkelosteus belongs in, they had never shown any signs of male or female differences. So we went on the hunt to find out the rest of the story. And it was then that we found another fish in the British Museum collections in London that showed an embryo, and in fact a couple of specimens with embryos in them. And then we realized there must be claspers in these males. So we went back to the GoGo collection, and there it was, sitting under my nose all along, and I'd completely missed it. One of my students had even done a thesis on this specimen, and we'd wrongly interpreted this structure as another pelvic girdle, but in fact, it wasn't. It was a clasper, a massive giant clasper with little barbs and hooks on the end, just like you get in some, you know, chimerids and sharks.
Was there one, or were they paired?
No, that was one specimen. They're paired structures, obviously.
They are paired. Okay, all right.
Yeah, but we then went looking through collections in the British Museum and Scotland, and we basically found other examples of common fish like Cocosteus from the Old Red Sandstone and Millerosteus that had these claspers. And fundamentally, all you need is a collection where you've got whole, complete fishes preserved and a large number of them, you know, from sites that yield hundreds or if not thousands of these one kind of fish. Because you do need a large population to get those specimens that are perfectly preserved with the tail that actually have those structures. And so we wrote a big paper in 2015 that sort of showed that these claspers were widespread through this other group of placoderms.
These claspers kind of hang to the back on the bottom of a shark and your organisms.
And redfish.
and ratfish. If you YouTube shark sex, you can see a very good demonstration.
Yeah.
And these claspers, why are they called claspers? Because they really don't clasp. They are inserted into the female.
Well, they kind of do.
Yeah.
Do they?
Well, they're in, actually, Ray, you tell me your interpretation of this one, because I don't have a clue why they're called claspers.
Well, if you look at them, just like you were describing, there's little hooks and things all over the things. And if you look at ratfish claspers, there's
why
always...
Why aren't they called barbs? Barbers.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right, Ray. I think that's probably where the name comes from. Yeah.
So.
But anyway, the rest of the story is that there was one major group of placoderms, and I referred to Bothrilepis earlier on in this interview, that these boxy sort of fish with bony arms on the side, and these are called the antiarchs. And whenever you do a phylogenetic analysis of all the placoderms, these come out right at the base, you know, as the most primitive of all placoderms. And up until 2014, we knew absolutely nothing about their sexual reproduction. And then specimens started turning up from private collections, like I'm holding this one in my hand here. This is a little fish from the Orkney Islands of Scotland called Microbrachius. And this one here with these big, they look like feet, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're actually claspers on the male, because here is the female.
But that's a tiny fish. That's got to be 3 centimeters long.
That's correct. It is small and had a little tail coming out from the bottom there. Anyway, so we eventually found the claspers of these fish. I had a couple of wonderful trips digging in the Orkney Islands in the remote north of Scotland.
That's nice and sunny.
Yeah. And this fish was the origin of sex in terms of the most basal member of a phylogenetic sequence to have these organs. And they're absolutely massive. You know, we call this fellow here Big Boy. You know, his claspers must be like a third the length of his entire body, you know, so he's very well endowed.
And they're sideways claspers. They're pointed.
Yeah, yeah. So they have big hooks. And so the other mystery with these fish is they have these tiny little arms with the hooks on the arms. And no one knew what the hell these arms were for. You know, you could only guess that maybe they propped themselves up on the bottom or something. But we nailed it, because with these claspers, how can a fish like this insert that clasper into the cloacal region of the female to deposit sperm unless they have some way of gaining purchase or organizing themselves?
Grabbing on.
And so these little arms would interlock, you know, like doing the do-si-do, doing the square dance. So the male could then move that clasper to the female and deposit the sperm. So we'd even solved what the first ancient sexual position was. Huh. It wasn't the missionary position. It was the side-by-side do-si-do position.
The Devonian do-si-do. I love it, man.
You're going to write a song about that, right?
That's easy to...
Okay, so why does evolution favor intercourse over just dropping your load and running?
Yeah,
into the water.
What is the evolutionary reason why males develop claspers, and what is that about?
I think, personally, it's got to do with the fact that up until then, since the origins of fishes almost 500 million years ago, there'd been this standard way of reproducing where it was a lottery. You know, you dump your load and you hope one or two of them survive. But then, during the Devonian, there was lots of things happening, lots of changes in the environment, oxygen levels rising and falling, plants starting to take hold on land, and, you know, new ecosystems opening up to be exploited. And so there was a far more competition. You know, many groups of fish had appeared and diversified during the Devonian, like sharks, like bony fishes. And so there was so much rat race competition in the water that this was a new way of saying, let's try something else. Let's just invest in a few young that come out ready to defend themselves and ready to sort of not be eaten straight away by something else. And whatever the reason was, this strategy was adopted by placoderms, and it worked. And they became highly diverse, and they were kings of the world during the Devonian. Hey, the placoderms ruled the seas, oceans, lakes and rivers of the entire planet for like 70 million years as the dominant life on Earth. So,
and where did they evolve to?
Well, they just reached a dead end and died out. Like most of the dinosaurs.
Was that successful?
But they passed on this reproductive method to sharks, and eventually it was acquired
by... Sharks are related?
Yes. Well, we believe placoderms are the ancestors that gave rise to both sharks and bony fishes. There's sort of
the link between them, I see.
Right, right.
So
this method was very successful. And when we look at modern animals like reptiles, viviparity, or the ability to give birth to live young, has arisen, you know, more than 100 times in some reptile lineages independently. So now it can be acquired or lost very, very rapidly in evolutionary lineages.
But John, your book, your beautiful book, I've actually got both versions of it. The Rise of Fishes just blew my mind. And actually, one of the things I think is really cool about it is you did all the illustrations.
I wouldn't claim all of them, but I did
most of them. Yeah. Right. You do pen and ink.
I'm a hack artist, not as good as you, Ray, but I did a lot of the sketches in rotary pen and then turned the clear sort of drafting film over and used coloured rotary inks on the backside to then get the colour. So most of those little reconstructions of fish are mine, but I also got some fabulous artists like Bill Stout contributed some artwork.
Right.
It's a great book and easy for a layman like me to understand. And you know what, Ray? It's on my coffee table and yours isn't.
Oh, man.
Ooh.
Oh, that's some shade there, man.
I've got Ray's book right behind me, the one cruising the fossil highway.
I see it right
that's
over
a,
there.
That's a fabulous book. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Do you have the Fossil Coastline book, by the way, the latest one with Johnson?
I don't. I think you guys sent me a PDF of it. That's right. But
I
haven't got the hard copy.
We'll make that right.
Speaking of coastlines, you have gone to the one continent I have not been to, and that's Antarctica. And I was reading Mountains of Madness, your book you wrote about your experience there. And I've been to Barrow, Alaska in winter, so at the edge of the Arctic sea ice, nothing like Antarctica. But I do have an idea of the cold and how being out there in 30 seconds could kill you.
Yeah, in midwinter maybe, but I was lucky to be there. I had 4 trips to Antarctica, starting in 1988, and then a big 3-month sledging expedition in 1991-92, where we actually, the old-fashioned way of doing it, where you dropped in by...
Across Darwin Glacier.
Yeah, dropped in by Hercules aircraft, and we had our sledges and our skidoos with tents, and we lived for nearly 3 months just sledging, mostly through unknown territory that hadn't been explored by humans before.
When you were crossing Darwin Glacier, weren't you worried? I read that you were sliding, the sledges were sliding on the blue ice.
Yeah.
Weren't you worried about crevasses and falling down?
Sure was. There was never a moment of, not being worried out there. For me, it was the first time I'd been on a deep field sledging expedition, because the expedition before that was mostly in dry valleys, but... So it was full of unexpected crevasse fields. Suddenly we're in a crevasse field. We've got to walk very slowly and probe the ground in front of us. There were times with avalanches that buried me up to my neck on a mountain slope. And once when I nearly fell through a crevasse, I just broke the surface, but threw myself to the left.
Oh, man. Seen via Facebook, you've been there more recently too, and you're going for Devonian stuff, right? Is that are you looking for lobe fins or what?
Yep, exactly that, Ray. I had 2 expeditions down there with Neil Shubin and Ted Deichler and the US logistics team staying at McMurdo, and that was out in the Transantarctic Mountains where Gavin Young and Alex Ritchie had been collecting back in the 1970s.
Do you need a Sherpa?
Yeah, there's so many people that want to come along on these trips that unfortunately the logistics decrees they can only be very small teams of, 5-6 people at the most. And one of those persons has to be a survival expert, the mountaineer
that keeps
you alive.
That's me, Alaska.
Ah, right.
Are there any lobe fins to be found down there?
Yeah, well, we found a number of new sites in the Mount Fleming area, which were very exciting. And we got a lot of new species from there, which include placoderms and lobe fin fish types, some with complete skulls and brain cases. So, yeah, we got the goods. We got some very interesting stuff, but we obviously can't reveal much on that until we write it up.
So you do have some stuff.
We've got some wonderful stuff that we're working on. All of this material is deposited in Philadelphia in the museum there eventually. That's its home.
Besides Metapisces with the embryo, what is your most incredible fossil moment that blew you away in your life? What is the find?
Well, in terms of not so much, it wasn't the most important scientific find in my life, but in terms of the happiest moment of finding a fossil, I think it comes back to sharks. I was at GoGo in 2005, and sharks were one group that were completely missing from the whole GoGo fauna, despite 60 years of collecting by British museums and Australian expeditions. And then it was on this one moment that I split a rock, and it was a small nodule, and it opened up, and I saw this jaw. And then I got my hand lens, and I saw these little teeth everywhere with multiple cusps. I knew we'd found the very first shark from GoGo ever, and I knew that once that specimen was prepared, we'd have a three-dimensional sort of set of bones of a shark. And, you know, unfortunately, it wasn't complete. It didn't have a brain case, but it had enough of the bones, the shoulder girdle, the jaws, and all the teeth, the many scales that were able to make a really good paper out of it. So that was the most incredibly happy moment of finding that shark after no one else had ever found one.
It's a little guy then? It's in a nodule?
We called it GoGo Sulacus. He was little. He was about a foot and a half in length. And since then we found...
Well, how big are the nodules?
Well, the nodules can be anything from the size of your thumbnail to almost 3 feet across. But the really big ones don't have anything in them. They tend to grow... They all grow around something organic. It might be a bit of algae or a bit of tissue or something. But most nodules contain absolutely nothing in them that you can visibly see with your eye.
Is that a chemical property of limestone dissolved in the ocean to create nodules?
Well, this was a particularly special. It was a tropical embayment with supersaturated calcium carbonate in the water and a euxenic layer of hydrogen sulfide in the water column. And we know this because the chemistry has been studied, that that's how the nodules formed. As the dead fish fell down through that layer, it started a chemical process that...
But the hydrogen sulfide is caused from living creatures, right? From algae?
That's right. Well, there are lots and lots of algae probably living. That reef was an algal stromatopoid reef. It wasn't a coral reef like today's reefs.
Okay, let me explain a couple things. A euxenic layer, spelled E-U-X-I-N-I-C, yeah, I know, means a layer of water that is both anoxic and sulfuric. Anoxic meaning no oxygen, and sulfuric, as John said, saturated with hydrogen sulfide. Both together slow down or even stop the process of decay in a dead organism. And an algostromotoporoid reef was more like a bunch of sea sponges rather than the coral we know and love and are currently bleaching at the moment, but that's another story.
So there's been lots of papers written on the chemistry of how these fossils form, and some of the really amazing work we're doing at the moment. My very first PhD student, Kate Trinajczyk, who's now our Dean of Science over at Curtin University, is leading a project on soft tissue preservation in GoGo fish. And this is amazing. We've got soft organs and stuff there that, you know, this hasn't been published, but it's in the system at the moment, shall we say, been submitted. You know, all sorts of amazing soft organs in these fishes are about to be revealed.
How remote is the GoGo? Is it easy to get to, or is it quite an expedition?
It's in the far north of Western Australia. It's not far from the town of Fitzroy Crossing, about an hour away from Fitzroy Crossing, but you need... You know, it's hard to get on those sites without the right permissions and the right access, which I like it that way because this is such an important site. We want to keep
it. They're protected then. That's good.
They're protected, yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, John. If you could get in the old time machine, when would you go back to? What time period would you go back to and what would you want to see?
Definitely the Devonian.
All right.
And I would want to see that first tetrapod, you know, walking around in the swampy water on land. I want to see how well adapted to the terrestrial life it really was. Maybe half fish, half tetrapod kind of thing would be fun to see. Actually, I did this in one of my books many years ago. I wrote three children's novels about, books for kids. And the first book was called The Mystery of Devil's Roost, about a cave. And these kids got into the cave and had indigenous art paintings of placoderms and dinosaurs on the walls. And then all sorts of shenanigans happen. Crystals light up and lightning strikes. They emerge. And they're in the Devonian, and they have to survive. And it's not just oh, this is a pretty harmless place. There were these really large arthropods attacking them and everything.
Eurypterids.
And they caught a Bothri lepus, cooked it and ate it. And they cracked the little arms and it tasted like lobster, you know. So that was me indulging my fantasies in that book.
I've time traveled back to that in my mind as well, but I thought it'd be pretty safe. There's not really much up on land to kill you other than maybe an occasional big scorpion. But
yeah.
So, John, what do you think was the first creature to exit the ocean, to leave the ocean for land and populate land? A Eurypterid?
No, well, we know that Eurypterids and also these other arthropods called euthycarcinoids were able to walk on land away from the sea as far back as the Cambrian. You know, the euthycarcinoids at least, not the Eurypterids. But
are there trace fossils of that?
Yes, there are. There's Cambrian and Ordovician trace fossils of these arthropods walking on land. And early millipede-type creatures, you know, there's lots of those. So it was definitely the arthropods that not only invaded land, but then later became the first invertebrate group to develop flight.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, the flying insects. John, actually, this Devonian world, I live in a place where it rains a hell of a lot. This summer, it's raining a lot.
Yeah.
That original scenario of our fishy ancestors crawling from dried up hole to the next little watering hole, we've thrown that out. Was that Devonian world that animals like Opisthostege, was that kind of a soggy, wet world where there was little difference between being below the water and above the water? What kind of world was that, do you think? Or do we know that environment? What is it like?
Well, the whole of the Devonian, as we've said, was nearly 70 million years or so long, so it was a long period of time. But let's talk about the late Devonian, right, when the fish were evolving into tetrapods.